Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, I'm very excited to have as my guest a first-time novelist, but a woman who's written five books of poetry. Her name is Honoré Fanon Jeffers, and her book is The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. I think I'm talking to the author of a great American novel, not just a great American novel, a great American feminist novel, and a great American black feminist novel, all three things. I can tell that the Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois took a long time to write. It's fabulous. It's so readable, moving, historical. It has taught me so much about American history and about writing. So I want to begin by thanking you, Honoré, for such an amazing book. How does it feel now that a book you've spent such a great part of your life on is finally published?
I feel very relieved. And I'm hoping to sleep a little bit at some point. Thank you so much for those beautiful words. Thank you.
One of the things that this show, Bookworm, is for the discovery of major works of literature. All we do on this program is literary fiction and poetry, and I don't do any books on this show if I don't like them. What I want to do at this time, when we're living in a culture where reading has fallen behind, I want to tell people what to read, and I want the people who are listening to order the books I'm talking to them about as soon as you've finished hearing the show. Now, this book is called The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, and it begins with an epigraph from W.E.B. Du Bois. It's an epigraph from Of the Sorrow Songs. Would you read that for us, Honoré?
Certainly. They that walked in darkness sang songs in the olden days, sorrow songs, for they were weary at heart. And so before each thought that I have written in this book, I have said a phrase, a haunting echo of these weird old songs in which the soul of the black slave spoke to men. Ever since I was a child, these songs have stirred me strangely. They came out of the South unknown to me, one by one, and yet at once I knew them as of me and of mine.
That's W.E.B. Du Bois, and he calls these things sorrow songs, and you call this book The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. Could you distinguish between a sorrow song and a love song?
Well, I think that for me, there's not that much difference between a love song and a sorrow song, because Dr. Du Bois was referring to the traditional spirituals, what we used to call, when I was a little girl, the traditional Negro spirituals. And he really loved Southern Black people, very much so.
I fell in love with Southern Black people, particularly with your narrator, Ailey. Unlike her family, which includes generation after generation of physicians. She has become, like her uncle Root, a historian. She's been studying the history, and that history of the South includes the history of her family. So we're going back in time to the time that the Native Americans, the indigenous peoples, inhabited the land, up to the present, where she has discovered documents that enables her to understand who she is, where she comes from, and why something within her has made her a historian. Now, history is very important to this novel, and yet it is a novel, a historical novel. Your last book of poetry is also a historical work.
For me, history isn't just about documents, you know, static pages covered with dust. History, for me, is a living thing. It's people. And so, you know, I've been in the archives, you know, off and on since I was a very young girl, in my early 20s. So, you know, a little over 30 years I've been in the archives. And there's something about the people that I encounter, you know, mostly African Americans I do research on, and they speak to me. I think of the great Toni Morrison, although, of course, I'm not anywhere near Toni Morrison. She was a genius, and we were blessed to be walking the same earth as her. But she would talk about the fact that whenever she started a new book, that she always had a question that she wanted to answer. And so in this book, one of the questions I was curious about, or several questions I was curious about, were, how did we get to this place? How did we get to this place as a country? How did we get to this place as a Black community? When I'm speaking about my own culture, how did this place in Georgia evolve, Chickasetta, and how did a family evolve? And I think you can only answer those questions through the examination of history, even if it's, as in my case in the novel, even if it's, you know, fictional history, some of it.
You start out with the first love song, which is a history of indigenous people on this plot of land. The land will be stolen from them. It will be stolen from them many times over. What we learn about the cruelty of the white men who were destroying the indigenous people and creating a place where slavery was the law. This is very painful reading. As I understand it, it is now called Afro-Indigenous culture. And I think you identify it as Black-Red culture. And we're not reading just about Black culture. We're talking about the joining of the African-American spirit with the spirit of the indigenous people, their beliefs about the land. As I learned, you know, no indigenous person believes that the land can be owned, and yet the warring white people in this novel are mostly fighting about ownership and property. And your narrator, Ailey, is coming to understand more and more about this because there are white people in her program, in the history department in the South, who believe they want to tell the story about the dearness of the Black mammies. And she knows that this is a story that they want to tell themselves. that she has got to escape those stories, yes?
When you grow up in the South, there's a romance that certain white Southerners, not all, okay, so I want to be very fair here, but certain white Southerners have about the South, and they create these fictions that slavery was very benevolent, that African Americans who have white ancestry that goes back to slavery, that these relationships were consensual. And one of the things when I first began my poetry career, and I would go places and I would read poetry, there would always be, you know, an elderly white lady that would come up to me and tell me that I reminded her of the maid or the nanny that had reared her. And when I was a younger woman, that would really infuriate me. It would really make me mad. And, you know, because I'd always be wearing a beautiful outfit and I'd always, you know, have on makeup and all of that. And I'd be very poised and, you know, articulate, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think it was maybe 5 years into writing this book where I began to think about, you know, these older white ladies who had spoken about these nannies and these maids and these cooks, and they would always refer to them as family. I loved, you know, Sally as much as I loved my own mother, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, what if instead of leaning away from family, I lean toward it? What would it mean to have a multiracial family and to have white members of the family who were in power over black members of the family, who you know, would not change Jim Crow?
I'm speaking to Honoré Fanon Jeffers. She's the author of what, to my mind, is a truly great novel. You are being very polite and respectful in saying that you don't deserve to walk the same earth as Toni Morrison, but I think that this is a novel in the category of beloved. But let me tell you, Honoré, I once had the terrifying experience of hanging around with a friend whose family came from Charlottesville, Virginia. And I have to tell you, as a Northeasterner, I never heard people talking this way. It was so belittling and so insulting. And not just that, it went without saying. It was a form of colloquial gossip that allowed people to say, I remember when the first black people were admitted to the University of Virginia, and this was actually said in my presence, Honoré. It was so funny to see a black man wearing a suit and tie. And I thought, my word. It wasn't until college that I visited Harlem, that I went to see theater there, attend dance pieces there. A friend of mine had written an opera that was performed there. And until that time, my parents had always warned me to stay away from Harlem. And I have to tell you, Honoré, it was a beautiful place. I think every community builds its ghettos so that when I moved here, it was many years before I went down to see the Watts Towers. Now, they are, of course, beautiful, but the whole community was extraordinary. I had a black boyfriend who told me that he was ashamed that his parents had never moved away from Watts. And when I got to see their house, I said to him, "What are you talking about? These are people who own a beautiful little house on a beautiful piece of property. How can you be ashamed?" And he said, "Of course, because Watts is the ghetto, and I wanted my parents to move from the ghetto." Now, your book, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, is full of issues of this kind, and I haven't seen them discussed in fiction before. And I have to tell you how profoundly moved I was by the developments in this book.
Well, thank you. I grew up in de facto segregation because I was born in 1967. But one of the things that I wanted to depict alongside of these issues of de facto and de jure segregation was also that African-American communities could be joyful. And so we see that in Chickasetta. We see the sort of joyful, even in the midst of inherited sorrow, we see this joy in communities. One of the things that I wanted to do is to present African-American communities in a straight no-chaser way, in a way that did not shrink from the way that we use language, did not shrink from our flaws, but also did not shrink from our beauties. African-American intellectual communities, such as at Rutledge College, you know, there's a quote by W.B. Du Bois that says, "You misjudge us because you do not know us." And I wanted people, everyone, I wanted African Americans to see ourselves as only we see ourselves in secret gatherings. And I wanted non-Black people to see us.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Honoré Fanon Jeffers about her fictional debut, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. It's published by Harper, and we'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Honoré Fanon Jeffers about her debut novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. It's a real epic. I couldn't stop reading it. It's over 800 pages long, and I read it in 3 or 4 days, and then I read it again. I'm very fortunate to have that kind of time to read, but if you happen to be at home because of a pandemic, pick up a book like this. It's truly an epic in which Ailey Pearl Garfield confronts her past to imagine her future as a Black woman in America. Ailey's grandmother is very light-skinned, and she, this grandmother, tells Ailey, "Be sure that you marry a light-skinned Black man because you are too brown. You have to think about your children." You're not just talking about elderly white ladies. You're talking about an elderly Black woman who feels that she has to help her descendants escape their brownness. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that anytime you encounter settler colonialism in a global context, you are going to encounter different communities where, I should say, European settler colonialism, where those in the community who have a closer proximity to whiteness are privileged. And it's no different than in Black communities. When I was growing up, there were, you know, there were families where you could not find one brown person in the family. When I was growing up in Durham, North Carolina, you would see, you know, whole generation after generation after generation of very white appearing people. This marked you as a particular socioeconomic class. This marked your upward mobility. And I felt it was something that people outside of Black communities were not aware of. It's a form of violence within Black communities. And it's particularly a form of violence against dark brown, you know, deep brown and dark brown Black women. I am a deep brown moving into darker brown Black woman. And I remember people would, you know, I would go into parties and things like that. And I'd have a friend who was lighter skinned and, you know, I would be completely ignored. People didn't want to talk to me. Guys wouldn't want to talk to me, that kind of thing. When we were at, for example, college parties or something like that. But then when I would go to working class African-American communities, there was never that problem. And so I began to realize that this was a class issue.
One of the huge debates in this book proceeds between those people who believe in W.E.B. Du Bois and his writing, and he is writing about what he called the upper tenth. There are other people in this book who have been reading Booker T. Washington and believe that Booker T. Washington addresses the working class who've been attending marches on Washington, the working class who are not ashamed to appear in public. Can you speak in this book about the relation of Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois and why, in fact, it seems like Du Bois is the special honoree of the work of Honoré Jeffers?
Anyone who has attended a historically Black college, which I'm a graduate of Talladega College, my mother and my two sisters graduated from Spelman College, my father taught at both Morehouse College and Howard University. He taught at Howard University alongside Toni Morrison in the early 60s. We are very familiar with this tug of war, this philosophical tug of war between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. There was a moment where Booker T. Washington was, as we say in Black communities, the head Negro in charge, okay, the H-N-I-C. I'm using a polite version of that, by the way.
Gotcha.
But there was a time where, you know, he was very much considered to be someone who all classes of Black people, you know, he was lifting them up, as it were. But then what began to happen is that upper middle class Black people began to resent. I'm condensing, you know, years of history here. They began to resent that Booker T. Washington was supportive of segregation. He was not publicly supportive of integration of Black people, having the vote, you know, all of that. And there came a time where W.B. Du Bois began to publicly attack Booker T. Washington, and this helped to turn the tide. Ironically, however, a lot of people don't know that behind the scenes, Booker T. Washington was funding challenges of segregation. But we would not find that out until years, decades after he passed away. So there was this ideological battle between those two men. And we talked about that when I was in college. We still sometimes, and by we, I mean Black people, we still sometimes have these battles because W.B. Du Bois had his problems as well. He was classist. He could be colorist, you know. So he had his flaws too. And so I thought that this would be sort of an interesting tug of war, a metaphor that moved through the book.
I've been talking with Honoré Fanon Jeffers, author of The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, published by Harper. Thank you, Honoré, for joining me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you.
Well, I'm going to continue. We're going to do a double show, and I want my listeners to know that you'll hear more talk about the love songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. I also want to remind my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping remotely, so you may hear some unusual sounds. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at all podcast services and on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. If you haven't already, please become a KCRW member. You are not going to be hearing interviews in this depth anywhere else. This is the time to join us. We need your support. Special thanks to my Bookworm Show collaborators, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, and my beloved engineer, PJ Shahamat. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again with Honoré Fanon Jeffers next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.